Spirits and Stone, The Secrets of Megalithic America. Our special guest, Glenn Crisberg, and we are going to be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Glenn Crisberg with us, of course. We're talking about his book, Spirits and Stone. Glenn, where do you get the book?
You get the book, well, of course, Amazon, but if you have a good local bookstore, you go in there and see if they have it or ask them to order it. I always like to promote local, buy local and, you know, local bookstores.
Super. Did you have fun writing the book?
Oh, I had a blast because I got to spend a lot of time out in the woods and wandering around and, you know, keeps me out of trouble and gets me some exercise and fresh air.
When you started looking at these structures for the very first time, were you in awe?
I was, and I have to say, when I made this connection with the Draco Petroform at Overlook Mountain, I was you know, in disbelief for half a day. So we had a GPS specialist from the New York State Museum, Susan Sweeney. She came out, again, probably almost 10 years ago now. I want to say it was 2008. And she did a GIS survey of the site on Overlook Mountain and documented about 46 small cairns and 6 great cairns and 2 serpent walls, excuse me, and a couple of springs. So she plotted all this on a topographical map and sent it to me. And when I first saw it, what struck me really were the rows of smaller cairns. These are the ones that are probably 4 to 5 feet high and about the same wide. And they were in crescent rows, just lined up. And, you know, to me, that was what struck me as something that was interesting. It wasn't until about a year later that I looked at the plot, and one of my friends, Dave Holden, had suggested that maybe it was a, you know, some of these stone constructions connected to make a star map of a constellation. Hmm. And I was somewhat skeptical of this because there are so many of them up there that you could, you know, kind of cherry pick and create all kinds of designs by connecting the dots. So I decided just to focus on the large constructions. There were 8 large constructions up there, the 6 giant or great cairns and the 2 serpent effigy walls. All of these structures are between 60 and 100 feet in length. So I decided to just plot those and connect the dots in the only possible manner possible. And when I did, I compared it to a chart of the Northern Hemisphere, a star chart, and only one came anywhere close, and that was Draco, and it matched very closely. I was just blown away by how close this configuration on the mountain of these stone constructions connected in a way that mirrored this constellation in the sky. So I got a, and I didn't know anything about Draco. You know, I started researching it and found out that it was one of the most important constellations in ancient mythology. It was recognized by the ancient Chinese, the ancient Greece, the ancient Persians, the ancient Celts, the ancient Norse, all ancient cultures. Most had recognized Draco as a serpent or a snake in the sky. So having made this connection, this correlation on Overlook Mountain, I got some astronomy software, and I put in the coordinates of Overlook Mountain to see what was in the sky above it. And sure enough, there was Draco sitting in the sky, always above.
There it was,
Overlook Mountain. And that's because, as I mentioned, Draco is marking celestial north. And I believe Overlook Mountain and this petroform that was built on it was also marked as a beacon, marking celestial north for anybody in the viewshed of this mountain, which was extensive. You know, you can see this mountain for 30 miles in all directions. So, I was certainly in awe of that. And it just kind of, I was scratching my head for half a day saying, how can this be? And what's the meaning of this? And since then, I've only really had one similar kind of epiphany or discovery. And that's the association I made with Dan Scammer Point on the Hudson River and the mouth of the Wappingers Creek across the river slightly to the north. And that's also a very important celestial relationship between that point of land on the river and the mouth of the creek. Dan Scammer Point was actually named by the crew of Henry Hudson's ship as he was sailing up the Hudson on his third voyage of discovery in 1609. His crew witnessed a ceremony taking place on a point of land on the Hudson about 40 miles north of Manhattan. And, natives paint with their bodies painted, dancing and chanting and around a ring of fires. And that's how it was reported in the log of the Half Moon. And Hudson's crew immediately called this devil worship and named it Dance Camera Point, which means devil's dance chamber. But why? Why was this point so important? And when I found that it aligned on a summer solstice alignment with the mouth of the creek right across the river, I understood why this was such an important spiritual place where they would have held their ceremonies.
Were some of these structures, Glenn, built to keep things in or keep things out?
Well, it depends on what those things are. I think that in many cases they were they were built in a way to be a transition between worlds.
So there's a lot of symbolism there.
Yeah. Yes, and this strong connection to the sky world and the underworld, and there are many symbolic relationships around many ancient cultures that have to do with elements of the sky, elements of the subterranean world coming together and being joined in the plane of the living here on the Earth's surface.
Did they have any practical purpose, or was it more, as you've just mentioned, this more esoteric reason?
Well, I think they did have practical purposes. I think they were multi-purpose. As I mentioned earlier, I think they were, in the case of the chambers, they certainly had a a shelter
protection
element.
Protection shelter, sure.
Many of these large stones, many of the large boulders that I document are not just what we would call calendar stones in that they align with the solstices, but they're also compass stones in that they're oriented to the cardinal directions. They'll have noses or prominent faces and points that have been, oriented to north, south, east, and west. Usually north, south, north, east, and west, south, so not so much documented, but a few instances of that. But knowing the directions of north, south, east, west to ancient cultures was extremely important, and they didn't have, the kind of compasses we have today with magnetic needles. They did it more through, through understanding the movements of the sky and where the sun was and positioned on certain days of the year at the sunrise and sunset, and that allowed them to understand pretty accurately where north, east, southwest, all these different orientations were. And they they left these markers scattered across the land that acted both as calendars and as compasses. So it doesn't get more practical than that.
Wow. Let's go to the phones now. West of the Rockies, Arnie is in Granite Bay, California. Go ahead, Arnie.
Yeah, hi. I'm from California now, but I grew up in that mid-Hudson area. My father had a farm in Hyde Park, under 10, I lived on, and my grandparents had a hotel in Pine Plains. I'm sure these names are all familiar to you.
Sure. Hyde Park is where Roosevelt was, right?
Sure. Yeah, right on the Hudson.
Yep.
And I lived in Fenton Hollow, and I can attest to the stone structures that were built by the early people because, my father's farm, the barbed wire fences followed all the stone walls and a lot of the stonework that was there way before that in the colonial time. But the other comment I want to make is I did a lot of research on the Iroquois Indians. And they're the Mohawk, which lived in that area. And one of the striking things I found, I'm looking at pictures that I could pull up on the very earliest camera pictures photography of the Iroquois, was they didn't look like the other American Indians, the Mohawk and the Iroquois. I don't know which tribes it was, but they had very similar features to Europeans. And I couldn't understand that, how that was and why it was different. And I really mused about the culture, and also their stature was a little bit different. They were not really short compared to the Europeans, and it's a question there on the culture and where the genealogy, where they came from. But the question I had was regarding, I would like to go to some of those sites because I'm going back to my high school reunion this October, and I'd like to go to some of those sites to see. But the problem that I would think I would encounter, because having grown up there and know the area, most of all the land is private. You know, it's not like out here in the West where we have BLM land, public land where you can walk all over the place. Are those sites visible? Can a person just go and visit them? And also, do you have a tour that you would offer somebody?
Yes and yes. you're right. Most of these sites are on private property, and I take pains in my book not to disclose their location to protect them from being disturbed. But there are a few sites that are on DEC land, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and they are easily accessed, and you can see some amazing sites. Also, through our nonprofit, Overlook Mountain Center, and that can you can go to overlookmountain.org. We do schedule monthly hikes and tours.
Oh, great. People would love that.
That are guided, and we actually have one this Sunday into Mink Hollow, which is one of the places here in Woodstock that has.
He's going to be out there in October. Do you have anything going on then?
Every month. If you go to overlookmountain.org and you look at the program schedule on the homepage, you'll see where we're going each month. October, of course, you know what the leaves are doing here in October. We have the amazing
light show
with the changing leaves, and that's one of the best times to get out in the woods and see these sights.
The fall weather up that way is gorgeous. I used to go to New England all the time near Fitchburg, Massachusetts as a kid. And
The Berkshires, beautiful area, beautiful not far area. From where we are.
Not at all. Let's go to David in Virginia. Hey, David, take it away.
Hey, good morning, George, and thank you for your for this program and all the programs that you put together, because I believe
you,
that they're a large part of the whole makeup of everything, which everything probably comes to a spiritual point at some point. I have a quick comment and a question for your guest.
Sure.
The comment is that you were asking about or talking about the number of people that it would take to put these cairns together, and something as important as survival and to know when the summer solstice and the winter solstice would happen would be for harvesting reasons and planting reasons. So it would, to me, it would makes sense that it wouldn't be just one tribe or a couple or 20 people. It would be several tribes possibly coming together to share, to have this knowledge so that they all would know when to grow and
probably men and women.
Yes. All the tribes. And the question to your guest is that has he seen such a thing where if they had that their cairns in that area, has he seen possibly or could have been possibly areas that you could plant corn and that type of thing, vegetables and all that stuff? Or would they be, or are they, those places all lost?
No, that's a great question, David, because many of these sites And George had asked about the practical purpose. Many of these sites are located at the headwaters of many of the major creeks and streams that feed the larger rivers. So these headwaters, and the headwaters are the surface areas where in the hollows and in the valleys the water accumulates and then forms the creeks and the streams. But there's also this element of aquifers and under groundwater. And there's a chapter in my book on Dave Johnson's research. David Johnson is a dowser who has associated the surface constructions and archaeological sites on the ground with aquifers and locations of what he calls areas of higher permeability where the water flows through the bedrock more easily. He started his research with a National Geographic grant down in Nazca, in South America, the Nazca region.
Oh, yeah.
And he associated the Nazca lines with underwater aquifers. If you go to overlookmountain.org and you read an essay that I just put up there, I talk about how it's possible that the Overlook Mountain site, which sits directly above, it's less than a quarter mile from a cornfield down in the valley floor that is aligned right with the the stream and the hollow itself, kind of geographically, it sits right there at the base of the hollow. And this is a Native American cornfield. There's a stream, again, that's fed from the mountain that runs right alongside this cornfield that has been documented to have been the place that the Native Americans did agriculture as long as they had been there. So you know, the answer is yes, they very much practice agriculture. In the Iroquois culture, the women were actually both the sky watchers and the planters. So they watched the sky and they said when it was time to plant and harvest. That was the role of the women, very important. And of course, many of the Native American cultures were matriarchal and the women kind of ran the show.
Makes you really appreciate Stonehenge, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing object as well, because it was also multifunctional. It was a burial site, it was an astronomy site. I think sites like Stonehenge and like Karnak, and I talk about this in the book, I believe these were early earth science centers. People came to study earth, what today we would call earth science, but it was hydrology, it was astronomy, it was geology, it was seismology. And many of these sites are built on faults.
That's right. Thomas in La Jolla, California. Hi, Tom.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And Glenn, fantastic research. You know, I comment and then a question. The comment, well, you talk about sacred sites and stones and sacred sites. And when you go around the world, stones are traditionally things of power. They're instruments of power. You know, for example, the monarchy in England, the throne has a stone underneath that's called the scone stone that empowers the throne. And the Celtics, the Druids, the Irish monarchy also had their stones. In Cornwall, they have Siege Perilous. And Australia, they had stones at sacred sites that the Aborigines utilized. And I'm curious, you seem to imply that these sacred sites are more than passive planetariums, so to speak. You know, instead of being a passive planetarium, I mean, why invest all of this effort to build this site? But perhaps they're much more energetic for healing, energetic for bringing fertility to the land, which you've implied, and perhaps for weather control, and perhaps for long-distance mental telepathy, as the Aborigines in Australia, they would use a sacred site to communicate 1,000 miles to another sacred site. And so I was wondering if you would address that. Were these more than passive ancient planetariums, but more alchemical, perhaps magical, divinatory?
All right, let's talk about that when we come back in a moment with Glenn Kreisberg and his book, Spirits in Stone. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're back with our final segment with Glenn Kreisberg, author of Spirits in Stone. And Glenn, Thomas from La Jolla had some great questions there. That could these structures be used for, medical purposes, developing energy, healing, and things like that? We already talked about the possibility it could have rejuvenated seeds for their corn crop. But what about the other possibilities?
Yeah, he made some really great points. And one thing I wanted to mention about the power of stones, as he mentioned, many of the cities and towns throughout Europe had a stone at their center. And here in Ulster County, where I live, the big city is Kingston. It was the capital of New York before the British burned it, and they moved the capital further up the river to Albany. But Kingston, it's always assumed, was the king's town. But it could just as easily be the king's stone. And every city, every small town throughout Great Britain, Europe, Ireland, had a stone at the center of their town. and that's where the public officials were sworn in. That's where, you know, that was literally the seat of power, was at the that stone. And where it was located always had a very important and prominent position. To his other points, as we mentioned earlier, these sites do have many multiple purposes, some of which are very energetic in their nature and do have to do with communicating over great distances, or at least between realms of existence. These practices, these shamanic practices, altering your state of consciousness through chanting or sensory deprivation or ingesting psychoactive ingredients.
Sure.
They were able to communicate with other worlds and other beings, and once you're in that realm, you know all bets are off. You can communicate over great distances. I always remember this demonstration. You remember this guy Karnak, the amazing.
Oh, Karnak, yeah, I did. Like Johnny Carson, and, sure.
Yeah, he was a little schlocky, but he always did these amazing things. And I remember hearing him on the radio actually doing a demonstration where he was in Japan and somebody was in New York and they were opening an envelope.
And then he'd guess what it was or something.
And it'd be like an elephant stamp, you know, just something random, and he would somehow pick it up. But in order for him to get this message, he would always ask them to take a crystal glass and fill it with water and place it in front of them and think about this object with their hands on this glass of water. And he would tell them that he's, you know, in Japan or thousands of miles away doing the same thing, and that the water somehow was the conduit through which the communication, the telepathic pathway was established. So to the caller's question about whether there could be these telepathic abilities associated with these types of sites or with the activities that took place at these sites, I think that's very possible. And I also think that these sites, again, acted as giant celestial clocks that were able to be used to track the ages of mankind.
Well, I got to tell you, you've done a great job for us, Glenn. I want to thank you. Your websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and I hope a lot of people take your tours. That would be just simply fantastic. One of our guests on Beyond Belief upcoming is Brooks Agnew. He did a show with me some time ago, but just did a brand new one updating us about his planned expedition to the center of the earth, UFOs, and all kinds of incredible things. Brooks was also a guest on Coast to Coast some time ago, where he shared his work about just what's going on in the world of human consciousness. Dr. Brooks Agnew entered the Air Force in 1973, where he became an electronics engineer. He has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, a master's degree in statistics, and a PhD in physics. He was a featured scientist in the 1997 Wendy Robbins documentary on HAARP, Holes in Heaven. Dr. Agnew has recently co-authored a landmark publication on the creation of the Earth, the Ark of Millions of Years. And here he is this hour on Coast to Coast. Brooks, how are you?
I am doing wonderful, George. Good to be on.
My pleasure, too. I have been getting so many phone calls about the possibility of a hollow Earth and a few about your planned expedition. I thought we'd get an update from you on what's going on.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one getting all the phone calls. Well, you know, just to give a real brief history, you know, in 2006, early 2006, I joined the expedition team, which was headed up then by Stephen Curry, who very suddenly and unexpectedly passed away in 2006. And we really, really miss the heart of an explorer that he had. So in 2006, I was tasked to take over the leadership of the expedition and try to put it together and keep it going. We did not have enough momentum to get it done in 2006. And so we set our sights on 2007, because in the winter of 2006, when that ice began to form, for the first time.
You mean there's still ice up there, Brooks?
Yeah, it forms it forms every winter, but it forms so thinly that winter that it actually broke off and exposed a section of ocean, a section of sea that has not been seen in modern times. They believe it was covered with ice for about 200,000 years. So we have an unexplored area of our planet that opened up. So we really pushed hard in 2007, and we just did not have enough momentum to get it done. So we set our sights on 2008. We really thought we had that done. And what happened was, unbeknownst to us, the economy fell apart. We had bank failures. We had investors that we were counting on who were worth a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, worth nothing, and they couldn't help it.
Oh gosh!
So, but you know, we didn't lose the money that we had put together. We kept going. We published a film, a short. We call it the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition Part One. We started at Mount Shasta. We followed the legend all the way to Tibet, and we brought back that film and produced a film as kind of a fundraising effort, and it aired in Japan and took first prize in the Genes of Galileo contest. 17 million Japanese watched that film. So we realized at that point that more people know about the Hollow Earth than knew about Middle Earth before the movies came out.
Well, that's true. Now, and give me, try to paint a picture for us, Brooks. If you're on the ship and you're going toward the North Pole, and you claim it's hollow, and we'll talk about that in a second. If you continue onward, based on the curvature of the planet, you'll slowly go right into this hole, I take it, right? And it's all ocean?
Yes, it's all ocean. And the theory is, and believe me, we had no small challenge trying to put together a measurement system to see if we were going over into a hole or not, because on the ocean, you only have about 8 or 9 miles of view, because then the curvature of the Earth takes over.
Yeah.
So we actually have to use the same kind of gyroscope that's used to stabilize missiles or spacecraft, not the kind used in airplanes, so that we can track the curvature of the Earth as the ship is progressing over the water. And when that starts rotating faster than the curvature of the Earth should allow for, it means we're starting to sail into what Russian maritime experts call the oceanic depression. That leads to, they believe, a hole into the inner Earth. Now, I'm skeptical because I'm a scientist.
You're saying you don't believe there's a hole in the center of the planet or there's a hollow Earth?
That's an accurate statement.
All right.
I'm a scientist, and belief has nothing to do with it. What I found was there's no evidence. No one has ever been there.
What about Admiral Byrd and his group?
Yes. Now, he flew over it at 2,500 feet, and that's why he's an aviation hero and not a statistic. We can't get anybody to fly over it at 2,500 feet. The lowest we could get someone to fly over it is 17,000 feet, and this area, very strangely enough, is always covered with clouds.
Brooks, if there was a hole in the middle of the planet, which would be hundreds of miles wide, why isn't NASA or some other space agency from another country giving us this information?
It's a good question. In 2006, February of 2006, there was an international treaty signed, and it's law in the United States. It's called the Data Denial Act, and it specifically bars the release of any data from weather or photographic satellites of areas above the 70th parallel.
Interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, if it's there, let's just speculate for a moment here. If it's there, what's the concern then? Why not tell us about it?
Well, that's a good question. You make an assumption that the military knows about it, that maybe they've sailed their submarines into it, or that they have some privy knowledge.
Or there's something else going on there.
Or maybe something else going on. But, you know, it's funny. There's an Indiana Jones aspect to this beside the, geological ideas that our planet may not be a set of tectonic plates floating around on a molten ball like we were taught in school. But maybe it's tied into this increased UFO activity. Maybe it's tied into this extreme jump in human consciousness, not just in this country, Tibet, China, Japan, everywhere we've been. People are really in sync with the planet somehow. They're getting ultra concerned about taking care of the water, the air, doing away with trash, switching over to electric vehicles, using alternative fuels. It's happening everywhere.
Well, it is happening everywhere. That's true. Yet this has been a story that has been circling this planet for so many years now. I just wish somebody would get in there and find out what's going on.
Me too. Now, we did think we had it done this year. We actually went to a Norwegian charter company. We thought, okay, let's go to a bigger ship, take 500 people. We just discussed this earlier this spring, you and I.
Right. Absolutely.
And that went very well. Look, we were going to get the cost down low enough where the passengers themselves could pay for the expedition and we could make it happen. And then the charter company ran up against the Russians. They will not allow any ship except theirs to go above the 81st parallel. We need to go to the 86th parallel. So we're back in the Russian camp.
Tell me a little bit about all of this and your latest work, The Ark of Millions of Years.
Well, The Ark of Millions of Years started out in 2004 with the first volume, which was on the creation and destiny of the Earth. I was approached by a religious archaeologist who wanted a physics side to a book on the creation of the Earth. And I was really amazed at what I found in these ancient documents. Lots of very accurate physics observations with just the missing science. So when we put that together, the first book came out and it went right to the top of the charts. I said, holy cow, you mean people are interested in this stuff? So we quickly got the second book out, and recently, last July, as a matter of fact, Volume 3 came out, and it went straight to the top of the charts. And now the trilogy is complete, and it discusses the origin, the destiny of the Earth, and it sets everything up for 2012.
Well, it sure does, and soon enough. There's only a few years to go, Brooks.
And, you know, it's interesting, the things that these ancient civilizations predicted would happen, darned if they aren't happening. The planetary alignments are happening, the oceanic currents are changing, the weather's changing, solar flare activity is doing exactly what the ancients said that it would do. And solar scientists are really baffled right now. They don't know what's going on with the sun.
I've been talking to some guests lately, Brooks, that talk about the sun having a brown dwarf twin and that this is responsible for so much havoc on this planet. Some people would call it Planet X, and that it was responsible, for example, the flood of Noah. What do you think?
I agree with that. I think that our sun is actually part of a binary star system. We just can't see it because it's not lit up. But the way our solar system moves and the way the pyramid is aligned with the star Sirius and has been for 11,000 years, as far as we know, means that our solar system is actually revolving around that star system. Something in there is providing the gravity for it to do that.
Does any of this conflict with spiritual or religious beliefs?
Well, of course it does. I mean, in the medieval times, we enforced upon the people the belief that the Earth was the center of the universe and everything revolved around us. And if it wasn't for the bravery and civility of Copernicus, we still wouldn't know it. Oh, well, maybe we would by now. But, you know, the fact that science and religion have been at odds for many, many centuries doesn't surprise us at all. And now it seems science is at odds with common sense. In a lot of ways.
So when do you go hunting for the Bermuda Triangle?
Well, I've been across the Bermuda Triangle many times. So there are certainly mysteries about it, but I'm not studying it, and I'm not an expert on it, but it is definitely an anomaly.
Brooks, you're also very active in conserving energy, conserving really this ecological disaster on this planet. How is that going for you?
Well, it's actually going a lot better than we expected. About 15 years ago, the company that I work for launched out building electric vehicles and quickly became the biggest in the country until 1998, when political aspirations in California ended the electric car mandates and the industry died with it. Gas was $1.05 a gallon. Who wanted electric car? But now gas is back up in price. It's going to stay up. It's not going down. And we are really concerned about greenhouse gases. So we relaunched Global Green Cars, which is the name of the company back in 1993, 1994, 1995, when we set all the world records. And it is taking off. We filed for a Department of Energy grant. That is looking really good. We passed our first review. And it looks like Just as the giants are beginning to topple to their knees, a nice, well-positioned independent car company is about to be the biggest producer of electric vehicles in the country.
That'll be very interesting to see what happens. Give us your websites, Brooks.
It's globalgreencars.com.
Okay, very good. And anything with the Arc of the Millions of Years, is that still available?
Yes, it is. That website is arcofmillionsofyears.com. We're still selling the trilogies. If you buy those books, Coast to Coast listeners will get the first two volumes as an audiobook for free.
There you go, Brooks Agnew. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Greg Bishop, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.